Patreon.com/previewday.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Flu season cycles back around every year. This year's flu season just began. Last year, a lot of people came down with the flu despite getting their flu shot because the virus mutated after the vaccine was produced. Every year, the virus mutates a little bit, which is why the shot is necessary each year. So what does this year's flu season hold? Will this year's shot be more effective? Should you get one? Who should get one? We're going to talk about that and about several other public health issues this hour with Dr. Marcus Plesha, Mecklenburg County's public health director. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Morning. Also joining us for the flu portion of the program today is Dr. Leonard Friedland, director of scientific affairs and public health at Vaccines North America, GSK. That's short for GlaxoSmithKline. Thank you for joining us by phone from Philadelphia, actually. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, and thank you very much.
You're welcome. Last year's flu season was unexpectedly harsh. Is that because the vaccine wasn't as effective as it was supposed to be because of the viral mutation, because it occurred after the production, or was there something else at play as well?
No, I think that's the main issue. Last year was that we didn't get as good of a match as we usually do, and so we had a prevalent flu virus that the vaccine didn't match up with perfectly.
Well, you're in the vaccine business, Dr. Friedland. How often does that happen?
That happens periodically. Fortunately, there are over 100 laboratories all around the world constantly collecting flu samples so that our scientists and public health officials can make the best decision for the strains that should be in the vaccine. This year, there are 4 strains in the vaccine, and everything is pointing that the strains that are in this year's vaccine are matching up well for what's circulating. So it looks like we're in a good position for our public health this year with a well-matched vaccine.
So we just entered flu season, I think, a couple of weeks ago. Two questions. Why is this flu season? What makes this so special? And because you can get the flu in the summertime, I suppose. And how long does flu season last?
Well, first of all, generally flu season occurs during the cold months of the year. So you don't generally get the flu during the summer season. It is in this period. And probably the peak of flu season, it's always hard to know when the flu is going to hit, but the peak is usually January, February, March. But we like to go ahead and get people immunized early because the vaccine lasts for a long
time. What is it about cold weather that allows the flu to be more prevalent?
I don't know that we really know the answer to that. There's a lot of theories. One is just that everybody's inside closer to each other. There's also ideas that your mucous membranes aren't as moist in the winter, and perhaps that sets you up to be more easily infected. But there's not a clear answer to that.
Have we seen cases of the flu so far this year in North or South Carolina in Mecklenburg County?
We have seen cases of the flu. It's still at low levels. We've actually, unfortunately, had one death from the flu in North Carolina this year.
Mm-hmm. And with
that's right.
Go ahead, doctor.
And it's also important to point out that our best tool to protect against influenza is vaccination. And the vaccines take on average about 2 weeks after they're given to really start to have their opportunity to protect. So the best time to get vaccinated is now, before the flu starts to really hit in your county.
Okay. Last year, well, because of the fact that the vaccine wasn't as effective as we had hoped, 218 people, I believe, in North Carolina reportedly died from influenza. South Carolina reported 156 flu-related deaths. Already this year, South Carolina is reporting 5 flu deaths. Is that small difference in numbers from last year, the difference between North and South Carolina, 218 versus 156, because of the population or because it's warmer in South Carolina in most of the state, and so they have a shorter, less severe flu season? Do we know?
I suspect it's because of the population. The other problem is it is very difficult to measure flu deaths because oftentimes when people die, we don't know that they had the flu. Many people who have a death as a result of the flu actually die because of another infection that the flu set them up for. So the numbers are not exact, and there may be a little bit of some differences there as well as far as how we report in North Carolina versus how they report in South Carolina.
Were those numbers average, or were they above average because last year the vaccine didn't work as well?
Those numbers were slightly above average, but we've been lucky. We've had pretty good years for flu mortality recently. Mm-hmm.
Do we understand why? Is that because people are getting the shot? Or more people are getting the shot, or is there something else at play there? Or do we know? the fact that we've had a better time, fewer deaths in
well, it's multifactorial. I mean, I think that we are doing a lot better at getting people the flu shots these days. That makes a big difference. The other issue is really just how virulent the strain of the flu is in that particular year, and that's what's very difficult to anticipate. Last year, we did have this strain of the virus that we weren't ready for with the vaccination, and it was fairly virulent. I think we just got a little bit lucky. Several years ago, we had a brand new strain that could have been very dangerous, and luckily it wasn't so virulent. So there's a lot of factors that play into that. But I do think we're, as Dr. Friedland said, the biggest thing we can do is get people to really take advantage of flu shots, which are fantastic. I mean, it's one of the best things you can do for your health is get a flu shot every year.
So Dr. Friedland, let's talk about these strains, because every year we get a slightly different version of the flu, which is why we have to go back and get the shot. Also, the shot doesn't last forever. You got to get a backup, a booster. Are these strains caused by mutations in a couple of different viruses, or are we seeing simply different viruses crop up around the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. So influenza can be caused by many, many various strains, but in general, four particular strains cause disease in any given year. We call these strains and groups the A strains and the B strains. We've known since the early 2000s that there are two types of B strains that tend to circulate and cause disease. And in the four-strain vaccines, we now have the opportunity to provide this protection against the two types of B strains that circulate. When we look at the A strains, there are typically two A strains that circulate every year. Last year, the A strain that caused the issue, the mismatch, was in something called the H3N2. That is the strain that's most likely circulating right now. And we know that this year's vaccine is well mapped to that H3N2 strain. And then we also have in the current vaccine the H1N1 strain that caused disease back in 2009 that Dr. Marcus spoke about. So we have these two A strains, and in the four-strain vaccines, we have the two B strains. And this is our best opportunity to provide protection. And this year, the CDC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, groups are following very carefully what type of strains are causing disease, and as stated, this year's vaccine looks to be well matched. So now the key is to get people vaccinated. And the recommendation is that everybody over 6 months of age should receive an influenza vaccine every year. Everybody's at risk for influenza. In the United States, we have anywhere from 25 to 50 million cases of influenza every year. And then you may want to talk about this as well, but there are certain groups that are really at high risk for serious complications from influenza. So it's really important that young children, older adults, and pregnant women and people who have underlying medical conditions like heart disease and lung disease, that they be vaccinated so that they themselves get protected and also protect people around them.
I don't know that we need to get lost in the weeds here with these various different strains, but I remember doing a program on this last year when we were really seriously worried about this new strain. And we got into the fact what these letters mean, like the A strain, the H3N2, and the H1N1 virus. The H and the N mean something. I don't know if it's important for us to understand that, because I just don't remember. But if you think it is, tell us what they mean.
Well, I don't think it's really that important to get lost in the weeds, but very briefly, they refer to the various proteins. They're called the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase, and it's the way that scientists can classify the strains. The important thing is that we know the type of strains that cause disease. We've known that the A strains and the B strains cause disease, and we've known since the early 2000s that there have been two B strains that have been caused disease. And in 2012, the World Health Organization made a recommendation to include two B strains in the vaccines. There now are these so-called four-strain quadrivalent vaccines that can provide this broader protection against the B strains. Actually, your listeners can go to cdc.gov and find information about these vaccines and another website called choose4choosemore.com to find more information. But the important thing is that scientists know the type of strains that cause disease. We can protect with our current vaccines, these four-strain vaccines, against these. The most important thing is that people be vaccinated.
Okay.
And we know that vaccination rates can be certainly higher, as particularly in the United States. And so the most important thing is to get vaccinated, and vaccine is available. And there are some really great places to find out where vaccine is available. The CDC has a website called HealthMap. It can be found on cdc.gov. where a listener can literally go in, type in their zip code, and find out what offices and what pharmacies in the area have vaccine, and it's available. And the other thing to say is that influenza vaccine should be at no cost to the public. Influenza vaccine is covered under the Affordable Care Act. It's covered under Medicare. And so vaccines should be available. Just check with your pharmacy that they cover it under your insurance plan. But influenza vaccine should be available at no cost to patients. And that's really important because we don't want cost to be a barrier.
In North Carolina, Dr. Plush, in North Carolina, is that necessarily true? Because there are a lot of people that fall through the cracks in Obamacare and fall through. They don't have Medicare yet. They don't have insurance. Is it free?
Yeah, I think that Dr. Friedland is right. Flu shots really are widely available. We actually, at the request of the County Commission, mapped out locally where you could get a flu shot across the county. And it was extraordinary. It's easier to get a flu shot than it is to get groceries. you know, they're everywhere. And in the vast majority of places, they're free. And certainly if you can't find one for free, you can always go to the health department.
So if you see a sign in your drugstore, flu shots available here, is that an indication that it's free or simply they're making it available for a fee?
I think it varies. There were some grocery stores recently that not only were providing them for free, they were giving you a coupon for groceries. So they're very interested.
So
why flu shots.
Why are flu shots free? Other vaccines are not free, are they?
Well, we have done a very good job in this country through various programs of making any kind of vaccine available for people who need it, and really making sure that people who are low income can get the flu can get vaccines for free.
There were what are called trivalent vaccines that cover three strains of the flu. Dr. Friedland just mentioned quadrivalent vaccines that cover the four strains: the H3N2, the H1N1, the B Victoria, and the B Yamagata. I'm not sure why they get
full. You're good.
I don't know why they get full names, and the H1N1 gets a number and a letter combination. But how do you know if the vaccine you're getting is the four protects against the four strains as opposed to the three strains?
Well, the way to find out is to ask. So ask your healthcare provider, ask your pharmacist, do you have the four strain vaccine? If they do, then that's great. If they don't, we don't want people to say, well, I have to have the four-strain vaccine. If your only option is to get vaccinated that day and they have three-strain vaccine, then that's what you should do. The four-strain vaccine can provide broader protection, but we want to make sure that people get vaccinated. There are a lot of options with vaccination now. There are vaccines that for young children. There are vaccines for older adults. There are vaccines that can be given in the muscle. There are vaccines that can be given under the skin. There are vaccines that can be given through the nose. So there's a lot of options, and the bottom line is that this should not be a barrier. Cost should not be a barrier, and availability should not be a barrier. The most important thing is to get vaccinated.
Let me ask some questions that are always asked every year at flu season time. Can I get the flu from the shot?
No.
Absolutely, positively
Absolutely.
Not.
That's correct.
You may feel, can you feel a little ill after you get the shot for a day or two?
You can have very minor reactions to the flu shot, but this is a really unfortunate misconception. I mean, flu shots are very safe, and you do not get the flu from the flu shot.
Can you be harmed in any way, particularly if you're ill to begin with, by getting a flu shot?
If people have a illness, if someone's sick, has a fever, we often recommend that they talk to their doctor or medical provider about whether they should have the flu shot then or wait a little bit.
We have to take a break. We'll come back more and talk more about the flu and the flu vaccine, etc., with Dr. Marcus Plusher from Mecklenburg County and Dr. Leonard Friedland from GlaxoSmithKline. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Womble Carlyle, a law firm focused on fostering Southeast economic development, hiring lateral attorneys, and serving business litigation, intellectual property, real estate, and mass tort clients. WCSR.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Momix Botanica, dance revealing nature's changing imagery through music and performers, both organic and inventive. November the 19th and 20th at Knight Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. President Kennedy started the Peace Corps over 50 years ago. It was a bold experiment sending volunteers from this country to help people in developing nations. Well, that program is still going on, and it's getting stronger with applications surging to a 40-year high. We'll find out why. We'll find out about what the Peace Corps is doing today from the director of the Peace Corps tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, Republican presidential contenders hold their fourth debate, how the candidates did, and new questions about whether today's televised debates are serving voters and the Democratic process.
Join the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the flu in this portion of the program today with Dr. Marcus Plesha, Health Director for Mecklenburg County, and Dr. Leonard Friedland, who is Vice President and Director of Scientific Affairs and Public Health for Vaccines North America at GlaxoSmithKline. As I mentioned, last year's virus, the virus mutated after the bulk of the vaccine was produced, and for some reason we couldn't respond to that. That is a function of the way these vaccines are produced. How are they produced, Dr. Friedland, and why couldn't we respond quickly to the mutation?
Yeah, flu vaccines traditionally have been produced through a culture that involves growing the virus in eggs. This is a tried and true manufacturing process that served our country and our globe very well. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of doses of influenza vaccines have produced in this way safe and effectively for the last number of decades. So this process works, and it works well. It also takes some time. It takes on average about 5 months from start to finish to make an influenza vaccine, to grow the virus up in the eggs, then to isolate it, separate it, find the components. In the four-strain vaccines, this has to be done with four different strains. They need to be put together into a vaccine. And then there's a whole lot of potency and other testing to make sure that the vaccine is the right dose and has no impurities. And then the vaccines need to be tested by the FDA. Actually, every lot is subject to testing by the FDA, and then they have to be packaged and filled. And this takes up to 5 months. So we actually start making vaccines, the whole vaccine manufacturing industry starts making vaccines in the February-March timeframe, as soon as the World Health Organization and the FDA choose those vaccine strains in the vaccine. And it takes this period of time. And so if a new strain is emerging, as happened last year, again, we're not seeing that this year, but when it happened last year, it started to be noticed in around the May timeframe. And that was simply too late to start over and make new vaccines.
So when these
vaccines...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. That's why.
No, I'm not saying that's why this year we're following this so carefully, and we're not seeing any evidence of any mismatch this year.
So do you grow the vaccine in the egg because of the nutrients provided by the egg itself, or because a lot of flus originate in bird populations?
That's a really great question that you bring up. It's the former. It's a media. It's essentially a soup. It's the nutrients that help the virus grow, and it's essentially a broth. And then the viruses, we know they grow very well in egg cultures, and that's how we grow up the virus.
And why is it?
Really
that,
well.
Why is it that most flus start in bird or swine populations?
It's the natural history of the host for influenza viruses. As you say, they have hosts in birds, in swine, in others. And this is also how we see this mixing of viruses as animals and humans come together in contact. And this is why influenza is so unpredictable, because of where the virus is. It has many, many different hosts, and occasionally a new strain can emerge. And that's why I mentioned earlier there are over 100 laboratories all throughout the world, in all of the countries of the world, constantly looking to get ahead of what's happening with influenza. There's a saying in the influenza scientific community that the only thing predictable about influenza is it's unpredictable. And so we have to stay vigilant and keep on top of this.
But that said, I would like to say, I just always think it is so extraordinary that we can do what we do with flu vaccine, that we can actually anticipate an infectious disease epidemic before it even hits. I mean, you know, last year we had this problem with not having a perfect match, but we hit it right so often. And to me, it's just one of the great sort of scientific marvels.
Why is it that I think Asia seems to be the epicenter of the development of flus through birds and swine and perhaps other animals as well? Why does that seem to be the incubator of the world when it comes to flu?
It's where animals and humans mix. If you've ever been or seen pictures of Asia, there are live bird markets, animal markets, and people interact with animals very, very closely.
But haven't we done that in the Western world as well? I mean, we spent the whole last several centuries with open-air markets, and you can still go to Europe and stand in a town square and there are live animals in the market.
I think it's just not the same level of interface with animals and particularly birds as what we have in our cultures.
When the vaccine is effective, which is most often, how does it work? What is it actually doing in your body?
Okay, I'll start on that one. So the way that vaccines work is we're looking to mimic nature. So in natural, if a person gets infected with influenza, they get infected with the virus, the body responds and makes an antibody and another immune response against that virus, looks to fight it off, but also then develops memory so that when we see the virus again, the body can respond with its army of immune cells and fight off the disease. So what the vaccine does is look to mimic that. In the influenza vaccine, there are so-called antigens, which are little pieces, let's say, of the influenza virus, and we're basically tricking the body into thinking it's been infected. It makes this immune memory response. And so then when we do get exposed to influenza in the real world, we already have our body says, hey, I've seen you before, and I'm going to fight you off. And that's how the vaccines work. So it's a miracle that it works.
So, Dr. Plesha, how do we get exposed? I know people sneeze or cough, and they expel water droplets. And if they have the flu, those water droplets contain the virus. And so if you come into contact with those droplets, then you are going to be perhaps infected by the flu. But do they live for a long time on surfaces like telephones and computers, keyboards and doorknobs and things like that?
Yeah, there are three main ways that people get infected. One is if somebody actually sneezes on you and the droplet gets into your eyes or your mouth. The other is if somebody just in talking to you, sometimes droplets can pass. And then probably the most concerning one is that somebody can sneeze on the table and you can put your hands on that same area of the table and then touch your
mouth. How long afterward?
Your mouth. Well, it depends on what the surface is. I mean, in some surfaces, it can actually be around for surprisingly long, several hours. Mm-hmm. In other places, the virus quickly dies. It also depends on how much mucus is there with it. That helps it live longer.
At what point do you become contagious? If you actually contract the virus, at what point do you become able to transmit it?
So probably a day or two after you contract the virus. It's quite quick. And unfortunately, you often become contagious a little bit before you become symptomatic. So there's a period in there where you don't know that you're sick. And this is why the flu shot is so important because, you know, a lot of people talk to me about, oh, I don't want to get the flu shot for this reason or that reason. And, you know, those reasons are often fine. But the point I want to make is, you know, if you have the flu and you give it to a child who's very young, you give it to a pregnant woman, you give it to an elderly person, you give it to somebody who has a debilitating illness, it can be deadly for those people. And that's the reason, that's the real reason people should think about getting the flu shot. You may not even know you have the flu yet when you pass the flu on to somebody
else.
So
not only do you owe it to yourself, it's kind of a public good.
It's a public good. You owe it to the other people in the society that we live in. You owe it to the people who are more frail than you are.
When people don't get the flu shot, and people don't get it, what's their excuse? Seriously.
They have all kinds of excuses. I mean, this perception that the flu shot causes the flu is really very widespread. I'm glad we've talked about it. And, I mean, it doesn't. But people continue to believe that. And there's all kinds of other reasons. It just really varies.
So we asked the question on social media, did you get last year's flu? Will you get a flu shot this year? Well, I'm interested to hear what people say. Do I have to let you go at this point, Dr. Freeland? Are you on a time crunch?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about this because, as we've said in this conversation, there are two populations that seem particularly susceptible to the flu, children and older people. You, Dr. Friedland, were a pediatric resident and chief of pediatric emergency medicine at Temple University prior to working for GlaxoSmithKline. And according to statistics, influenza causes more hospitalizations among young children than any other vaccine-preventable disease. Do we understand why?
It's a disease that, first of all, is very contagious and can be spread. And young children are still developing their immune system, so they're just more susceptible when they get sick. And their lungs are not, and their airways are not as mature and grown as older people. So when they start to develop an infection and they get mucus in their lungs can begin to constrict, and they can develop what we call secondary complications, pneumonia, otitis media, ear infections, things of that nature. And so they're just very susceptible because essentially they're small and their immune systems are not grown up.
Why are older people more susceptible to the flu? And when we say older people, who are we talking about? 65 plus, 70 plus, 75 plus? What are we talking about there?
65 plus, and it's really the other side of the spectrum. As we age, particularly when we get to 65 and older, our immune systems tend to decline in their ability to protect. In science terms, we call this immunosenescence, so weakening of the immune system, and we see it as we age. So we're just more susceptible when we're very young and we're very old. But also, let's not forget about people who have underlying medical conditions, heart disease, lung disease, or those who have immunocompromising conditions because they're on a medication to treat cancer or some other medical condition. These populations are also at great risk. And so that's why it's so important that not only they be vaccinated, but the people around them be vaccinated so they're not spreading influenza.
I'm glad you brought that up because there are some studies now that say there are some drugs that people take on a regular basis that can interfere with the effectiveness of the flu vaccine, among them statin drugs, which people take to lower their cholesterol and fight off heart disease. The study found that statins impair the ability of the body's immune system to fight off the flu. Is this the first time we've seen effectiveness diminished by other drugs? One of you, Doctor.
No, I'm not. I was going to say that I am not familiar with those data, so I'd have to review those studies.
Are you aware of this, Dr. Plesha?
I was not aware about the statins, but, you know, this is a widespread problem because we have so many pharmaceutical agents. We do, and people who are on many things, we do see all kinds of interactions.
Well, let me ask you, if the two of you are not familiar with this study, is this study, should we be concerned about it? I mean, both of you are fairly up on the literature, it would seem to me, so should we be concerned about it, particularly if you're taking a statin drug? Should you call your physician and say, am I more at risk for the flu? Will I be protected by the shot? And will they know? And if they don't know, is it in your best interest to go ahead and get the shot anyway?
Well, I don't see any reason why there's any risk to getting the shot. It's just from what I'm understanding about what you've said, it may not be as effective if the shot and the statins interfere with each other. You know, these are both conditions that are significant for people, and you know, probably this is a case where it would be wise to speak with your doctor about this particular case.
One thing I read, and I wish I could get my hands on it right now to tell you what the study said, but I do remember that the study said that you should not stop taking your statin drugs just because you think it's flu season. You should talk to your physician about that.
I'm sure that's accurate, and you also should make sure that you're protected through vaccination, not only with influenza, but with pneumococcal vaccination, particularly for older adults. People who are on cardiac medication are, you know, many of them will have underlying other medical conditions, which will make them more susceptible to infectious disease in general. And that's why vaccination is such an important tool, not only, again, for influenza, but also for pneumococcal and for the other vaccines that are recommended for adults, zoster vaccine for the older adults, and pertussis vaccines for all adults, including now also pregnant women. So it's so important that people who have other medical conditions that they utilize vaccination as a tool to improve their general health so that they can remain healthy and be productive.
So the symptoms of the flu, how do you know you have it? How do you know it's not a cold?
Tends to come on very suddenly, a little more suddenly than a cold does. Tends to be more severe type of symptoms. A lot of the symptoms are the same: a cough, runny nose, fever. Tend to have a little higher fever in the flu. I mean, you just feel much sicker when you have the flu than when you have the common cold.
And what's the best? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And in addition, when people have influenza, it's much worse than a common cold. People can be laid up in bed, miss work, miss school, unable to care for their children or if they're caregivers for their parents. The economic impact of influenza is thought to be over $1 billion of lost productivity in the United States. It can be a very severe illness, particularly in those who are very young, very old, and with underlying medical conditions. So it's not your common cold, and it's something really worthwhile to avoid having.
How long are you generally sick? A week?
Yeah, a week or so. I mean, so it's a longer duration than the common cold.
And
sometimes people can go on with, you know, oftentimes you'll see people who've had the flu who will have a cough for a long time afterwards because of the inflammation.
When you get the flu, you got it. It's too late for the shot, right? And if you get the flu, are you essentially immune from getting the flu again that season? Or could you have gotten, if you hadn't gotten the shot, could you have gotten one strain, get over the illness from that strain, and 3 weeks later get another strain?
Probably once you've had the flu for the season, you're unlikely to get it again. I mean, you always could get a different strain, but it's unlikely.
Do things like Tamiflu help after you've gotten the flu?
They appear to at best have some marginal benefit right now, and that's not true for we do use those kinds of medications oftentimes in group settings where we're trying to keep a flu outbreak from spreading. But unfortunately, you know, at best they're going to cause you to get better maybe a day earlier, so they're not as effective as we'd like. And that's why, as Dr. Friedman and I are both saying, you know, your best bet is the flu shot.
And Tamiflu and Relenza, these antiviral drugs,
that's correct.
They are not over the counter. You have to get your doctor to prescribe.
Right.
Doctors say that the best prevention, as you have said today, is getting the flu shot. And according to GlaxoSmithKline, there is a plentiful supply available this season. Normally I would hear that and I would say, you're just trying to push your product on us, but it's generally free. So you're not. You're expecting to ship between 32 and 38 million doses, and the industry overall expects to distribute 150 million doses in the U.S. Does that cover us all?
Based on predictions of how influenza vaccines have been utilized over the last number of years, that quantity of influenza vaccines in the United States will provide a vaccine for everybody who is interested in having one. It takes an entire industry to make this happen. No one vaccine manufacturer can produce enough influenza vaccines for the United States. So it's a real great example of a network of vaccine manufacturers, public health officials, all working together to make sure that we have enough vaccine, which we do this year, for the whole United States population.
Dr. Leonard Friedland is Vice President and Director of Scientific Affairs and Public Health with Vaccines North America at GSK, GlaxoSmithKline. Thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us, Dr. Marcus Plesha, who's the Health Director of Mecklenburg County. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about other things that are of health concern to the public in the county. So stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Libraries Get Ready with Words, encouraging success in young children through vocabulary building. Parents and caregivers can teach a child words of the week at getreadywithwords.org. And Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at diamondsprings.com. Republican presidential contenders hold their fourth debate. So on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they will talk about how the candidates did last night and discuss whether today's or yesterday's televised debates are serving voters and the Democratic process. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. You can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or reach us via email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
We're heading into a part of the Amazon rainforest that the rubber tappers call enemy territory.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Tonight's win is a win for Charlotte. Yeah!
And Roberts borrowed a line from President Bill Clinton to explain what swept her to victory.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Marcus Plesha, Health Director for Mecklenburg County. We're going to move on to some things that beyond the flu that are of concern. But before we do that, we have a comment on Facebook from Violet who says, absolutely no mention of Guillain-Barre. Vaccines are important, but your expert sidestepped all questions about complications. Are there complications with the flu vaccine?
Well, you know, now there are complications to anything that you do. And so there certainly are complications with the flu vaccine as well. Most of them are very rare. The majority of them are mild. The issue about Guillain-Barre, that's probably the most severe potential complication. It's a condition that causes neurological problems, weakness, and potentially even paralysis. Tends to be self-limited, meaning people develop it, but then it gets better. And the one point I would make is that although the flu shot, there is some correlation between having a flu shot and having Guillain-Barre, you're far more likely to get Guillain-Barre syndrome if you get the flu. So, you know, when you weigh the two, the risk is higher for people who've had the flu than the flu shot. But that is there, you know, like anything, there are always some potential problems.
You mentioned early in the program that children as young as 6 months
yes.
should get this vaccine. And there are a lot of parents who are very worried about vaccines. And we have this whole movement out west where parents are refusing to get their children vaccinated. And that puts the whole population at risk. We've seen an outbreak of something out there. Are the complications or the risks of complications associated with the flu vaccine in very young children less different than other vaccines that young children normally get?
I think they're pretty similar. I mean, the complications of any kind of vaccine really are very small, and you know, a very, very small proportion of people who get vaccines develop any kind of problem from them. Now, I know there's a lot of anxiety and concern about this. I mean, unfortunately, people forget the ravages of these infectious diseases back in the day when we didn't have vaccines, where
people died in the thousands.
Thousands of people died, and particularly young children. You know, what a terrible thing to lose somebody so early. And,
right.
you know, unfortunately, that is all forgotten, and there's but it is also a very small proportion of people who have these kinds of significant concerns. Most people, I think, trust vaccines.
Is the dosage in the vaccine that you would give to a six-month-old or a two-year-old different?
It's a smaller dosage, yes.
And is it a bigger dosage in those who are substantially older, who have less effective immune systems to begin with?
In people who are older, there are two approaches. There's the quadrivalent vaccine that we talked about, and then the trivalent vaccine, there is a sort of double dose of that that you can give to elderly people. The idea is that elderly people often don't have as strong of a reaction, of a positive reaction to a vaccination, and so we've come up with this new vaccine that kind of gives them twice as much to really try to get their immune system fired up. It's not clear, you know, if that works that much better than having the quadrivalent, but that is an option for people who are older.
So let's move on to things other than the flu. There was a recent report about the consumption of meat and its connection to cancer. And we've known for some time that there have been concerns about consumption or overconsumption of meat, and also in the way that meat has been cooked. Now they're saying that eating processed meat like hot dogs, lunch meat, corned beef, can raise the risk in humans of getting colon cancer. That's from the World Health Organization. On what do they base that opinion?
They base that on a range of different studies that they've looked at over time. I mean, there are a number of things that we're concerned about that could cause cancer, particularly colon cancer, and processed meats has been on the list for a long time. I think that there's been enough new data to suggest a link that the World Health Organization was confident to come
well,
out
well,
with
they did,
that
it's a combination of 800 studies by 22 right. public health organizations, cancer experts from 10 different countries. What is in processed meats, like a hot dog, that might make it carcinogenic?
I don't know that we know that with certainty. It's probably the preservatives. It's probably the chemicals that are added in there to process the meat that are causing the carcinogenic effect.
The study warned that consuming 50 grams of processed meat per day increased the risk of colon cancer by 18%. Let's talk about what 50 grams is, because we're in America and nobody knows what a gram is. How big is 50 grams?
50 grams, I guess, is maybe a part of a hot dog.
Part of a hot dog.
Yes, I think a whole hot dog would probably weigh more than 50 grams.
So if you ate part of a hot dog every day, your chance of getting colon cancer increases by 18%. I got to tell you, that doesn't sound like much, is it?
18%?
Yeah, 18%.
Well, 18% perhaps for an individual is not a lot. For a population, 18% is huge. I mean, if everybody stopped eating processed meats and the rates of colon cancer went down by 18%, that would be an enormous
really?
Reduction. Yes.
Okay. By the way, the 50 grams is also two slices of ham or a sausage. I just found that in the notes. That's not a lot of meat.
I think the other thing is that is daily consumption.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know that people are, you know, a lot of people are eating a hot dog once in a while. That's a very different situation than if you're having a hot dog for breakfast every day.
If you go to a lunch place and they're serving sliced lunch meat that's not directly off a roast beef or a side of beef or a carcass of turkey, in other words, it's been processed in a plant and it's off a roll in the deli, that's processed meat,
that's
right?
processed meat. I think the basic recommendation that comes out of this is that there may be some risk there, and people should perhaps be a little more attentive to
how
much.
So what are we supposed to eat? I'm serious. Everything causes cancer, it seems to me. I don't mean to make light of this, because that's an important study. But
well, I mean, fresh foods, though, is probably what we're – not probably. Fresh foods are what we're supposed to eat. I mean, everybody knows –
Fresh foods would be.
Well, the best thing is fresh vegetables. And, you know, fresh vegetables versus cooked vegetables versus processed vegetables. I mean, the nutritive value goes down significantly the more you do to the food source as you begin to process it. So, you know, the fresher the food, the better. I think that's one of the emerging concepts here.
This study put processed meat in group one. There's several different categories of cancer-causing things. Group one, which means there's sufficient evidence that it can cause cancer. Red meat is in group 2A, which is classified as probably carcinogenic to humans. How do things like this compare to what we know causes cancer, like tobacco?
Well, I mean, tobacco, I don't – the classification you went through, I'm not totally remembering, but
that's fine.
Tobacco would be a – I mean, tobacco is sort of the most longstanding thing that we know causes cancer. I mean, we've known that since the 1950s. And so, you know, those are the places we tend to put the greatest focus, because the risk is very clear. The amount of tobacco that you would need to – I mean, tobacco, even being exposed to somebody else's cigarette smoke, can put you at risk. So, you know, we've tended to put the greatest emphasis on that. I think these processed meats are concerning, but I wouldn't put them at the same level as something like tobacco use.
The American diet, particularly fast food American diets, consist of a lot of these meats, it seems to me. Hamburgers on a charbroiled grill, we know that charring sometimes has carcinogenic elements in it. You got hot dogs, you got bacon, you got ham, you got sausage. Other Western nations probably consume a lot of these meats as well. Is that why there seems to be some evidence that Eastern diets, Asian diets, that haven't been contaminated by Western influence, and the Mediterranean diet seem to be a lot more healthy?
They do seem to be a lot more healthy. The one that's probably the most famous is the Mediterranean diet, which is very healthy. It's also interesting that you can take people from a different country, from a different culture, and they move to the United States, and suddenly they develop all of these diseases that were far less common in the country they came from. So there is something about the way we live our lives, and I think that the amount of processed food that we eat is probably a big part of
it. It's enormous. It's difficult to find unprocessed food. You go to the grocery store, most of the groceries in the grocery store are processed foods, are they not? Unless you walk the outside aisle.
I would say if you go into the produce area where there's lots of fresh fruits and vegetables.
The outside aisle.
Is the outside aisle. Yeah.
But the meat case is on the outside aisle as well. You just got to pick the right meats. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, these are – most of the concern that came out of the World Health Organization is processed meats. And you can certainly buy meats that have not been processed, and those are not going to have the same risk.
In fairness, the North American Meat Institute – as you might expect, defends red meat, saying that it has high value proteins and important micronutrients such as B vitamins, iron, and zinc, and that cancer is a complex disease not caused by single foods. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we need to be attentive to these kind of studies when they come out. And, I do think there is increasing concern about the amount of processed food that we eat. Now, on the other hand, that's not to say that eating meat is something that should be avoided altogether. I mean, oftentimes we swing from one extreme to the other, and I would say that this particular recommendation or proclamation from the World Health Organization, people don't need to swing to an all or nothing. But if you're eating a lot of processed meat, if you're eating processed meats every single day, it might be wise to cut back.
Mm-hmm. They were talking – the North American Meat Institute were talking specifically, I think, about red meat. And the World Health Organization reports that high-temperature cooking, where the meat comes in direct contact with the flame, which we love to do in America – it's called grilling – produce more carcinogenic compounds. But they went on to say that there were not enough data to reach a conclusion about whether the way meat is cooked affects the risk of cancer. That sounds new to me, and it sounds very confusing. What are we to take away from that?
Well, an organization with the reputation of the World Health Organization is not going to come out with a recommendation about what causes cancer without being sure that the science is very strong. So I think what they're saying is that although there are major concerns about how meat is cooked, particularly if it's seared and if it is burned a little bit like we often do on our grills, there's potentially some risk there. That doesn't go away, but the science still isn't there to make a hard and fast recommendation about that.
A couple of weeks ago, the American Cancer Society came out with, a finding or a recommendation that a lot of people find very puzzling and confusing, and those were their recommendations on mammograms and when to get them. They raised the age for women to start getting them, and they stopped them earlier than ever before, and they reduced the frequency after the age of 55. We had two doctors on this program for an hour talking about this, one of whom agreed with the American Cancer Society's recommendations, the other did not. What are you hearing in your situation as the health director for Mecklenburg County about this?
Well, the big thing I'm hearing is that how confusing this is. I actually don't think that the American Cancer Society recommendations add confusion. They begin to add a little more clarity. This all started in 2009 when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is probably the main task force who set recommendations for cancer, came out with recommendations that women between the age of 40 and 50 should talk to their doctor about whether they need a mammogram or not. And then at age 50, it became much more clear that they should get one. So you have that. The Preventive Services Task Force is about to come out with recommendations again that I think will be similar. And then on top of that, you now have the American Cancer Society, who traditionally have been a little more conservative, saying the same thing. So I think for women who are really worried about breast cancer, they should talk to their doctor. But by all means, those women can continue to have mammograms in their 40s. But for women who are not who want to do the right thing but are not – it's not something that causes them great anxiety, I would think for those women now – there's a number of recommendations suggesting that if they want to wait until they're a little older, that's okay to do. I don't think that creates confusion. I think that this actually, science changes. That's one of the frustrating things about the reaction to these recommendations. I mean, we're using The recommendations starting at age 40 go back to the 1990s when, you know, we first started doing mammography. We know so much more about how to detect and deal with and treat breast cancer now. And the recommendations should change as we know more. I'm a little frustrated at the reaction this time around. You would think when a second body comes up with similar recommendations, people would begin to say, you know, maybe it's time to rethink some of this because it's two decades later.
You took office as the Mecklenburg County Health Director in 2014, and almost from the beginning, you championed a tobacco-free Mecklenburg campaign. The Great American Smoke Out Quit Smoking Day is coming up November the 19th. Are older people quitting smoking? Are fewer younger people starting?
Well, I mean, nationally we are seeing good direction as far as less people smoking. Now, still close to one in five adults smokes or uses tobacco, and that's a lot of people given the level of risk. Now, as far as what the impact of the ordinance that we recently did, that ordinance took effect in March. It's a little early to know what the effect of that has been. We will begin tracking this on an annual basis with our own data to look and see what smoking rates are doing. It'll be hard to know if they go down, if it's because of what we did back in March or if it's because of other things, but I think this will make a big difference.
On Monday, the White House issued the Healthy Communities Challenge, which seeks to engage community leaders in areas with large numbers of uninsured citizens to help them get insurance coverage. Atlanta is participating. Richmond, Virginia is on board. Nashville, Tennessee is also doing it. Are we participating in any way?
Yes, I understand that. You know, this just came out, so I haven't heard the specifics of what we're going to do so that we can be effective in competing in this challenge. But we've done a good job here in North Carolina at getting people enrolled. And, you know, the overall sort of political culture for it has not been particularly supportive. And so I think even with that in place, we've enrolled a lot of people in the state. We are one of the leading states as far as enrolling people in the Affordable Care Act.
Yes. Let me ask you this. We only have a minute left. Under that act, is insurance affordable? Do consumers have a choice? Are enough people covered to make this a healthier community? Or are too many people still falling through the cracks?
Well, I have major concerns about the fact that the one piece of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, is something we have not done in North Carolina. That is a huge population of people who could be – of people who have real risks, who live close to poverty, who are often the people who have the worst health. If we could help that group, it would probably be one of the most profound things we could do in this state.
Is there a move to convince the governor or the legislature to move in that direction?
Well, yes, there's been a move for a long time. I think they may be getting there.
Okay. That's Dr. Marcus Plesha, who is the health director from Mecklenburg County. Thank you for being here for the whole hour. And Dr. Leonard Friedman joined us earlier from GlaxoSmithKline to talk about the flu vaccine.